Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled This Is Work, and it's about Christopher Collins' new book, Salsa Night at the Hilo Town Tavern.
Hilo.
There's no longer the.
So wait, what's the title of this book now? Wait, I'm confused and lost and scared.
It's called Salsa Night at Hilo Town Tavern.
Ah, all right. And so, yeah, and that's the, and This Is Work is the title of the first poem in the, in that work. And so for our guests for this episode are some people who know something about this great new book called Salsa Night at Hilo Town Tavern. Mr. Christopher Collins and Ms. Margaret Bashar, who is his publisher. So we have poet and publisher. This is a new, grand, terrifying experiment in podcasting, folks. Thanks for coming along. Thank you. Hello. Hi, folks. Hi. Say something to yourself. Hi.
Thanks for having us.
Hello,
you're
Hilo.
Welcome. Hilo, yes. And we wonder if we could just dive right in and do and start with a poem and then sort of let the podcast and conversation radiate out from there, if we so could, Christopher.
Sure. Since you already referenced this, I'll start with This Is Work. Like chipping away at the world's first glacier with your tiny black axe, or collecting canines from all the mouths of all the beasts who chase their meat across the dusty African veldt, or stacking plate after dirty plate in your family's first apartment until the ceiling buckles and the stars finally take notice, or harder still, writing one true thing. Okay?
Yes, fantastic, wonderful. And of course, the reason why not only is it a catchy short title that makes for a good URL, but I wanted to...
Sure does.
You know, start with this poem or name the podcast after it. Start with it is... I like the idea of sort of embracing the struggle of writing.
Yeah.
And writing about embracing that struggle, right? And in a weird way, my thought is... Because so that is going to be, right, the first poem in the book, right?
Yes.
People are going to open up that book and...
That's the poem.
That is the poem.
That's it.
Which I think about, you know, the way a good book of poetry and this importance of sequencing and how you have, like, sort of a narrative that's built around. Mm-hmm. And I thought that that puts the reader at such an interesting, intimate, and in some ways, I think, deliciously problematic place. You know what I mean? Of saying, you know, this is what you're getting. And I was thinking about, you know, your thought process in terms of sequencing and putting that poem first.
It's interesting. One, I'm going to turn it over to Margaret because she did sequence it that way. That poem is probably the oldest poem in this collection, and it's been around for a few years. Mm. When I was digging through stuff, I found it again and tinkered with it a bit. And it was in and out of this manuscript a few times.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I wasn't really sure it should be in here, and then I thought, I'm going to throw it in there, and if Margaret doesn't like it, it's coming right back out.
I'm okay with that.
And it was like the second or third poem in the original sequence, and Margaret right away was like, okay, here's what we're changing.
I mean, I generally actually have a very light hand with editing at Hyacinth Girl Press. I usually will have like one or two things that I talk to the poet about that like would be my personal suggestions if I were the one who was like 100,000% in charge of the manuscript. But I feel like when it comes to my press, I feel that it is a collaborative process of helping the poet put the manuscript that they feel is most representative of what they were going for out into the world, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that my feeling with that poem is, I mean, I appreciate the idea of like a quote introductory poem to a manuscript that doesn't necessarily feel like it's trying to be an introductory poem.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like that poem really achieves that of being a good, a good entry point more into the manuscript. I wouldn't necessarily call it an introduction as much as an entry point. Mm-hmm. And I believe I'd actually heard you read that poem. So I think I might have had some familiarity with it when I came to it in the manuscript. Yeah. But I think it's interesting in part because there is this ongoing conversation that I see people having about art and about writing, about what qualifies as like real work. And whether or not, you know, being a poet or being an artist qualifies as like actual labor and like actual real work. And so I find that the way that this poem engages in that conversation, I find that to be a very compelling element to that poem and to elements of this manuscript, like, overall.
Yeah, and if we could, I'd love to unpack the two parts of that. You know, the idea... There's two parts of it for me, and I think there's two questions of value, and I think it's something that all creative people, and I think even non-creative people, and even maybe even people who don't even like the arts, kind of have to decide for themselves. And one is this notion of artistic work as labor, you know, and even in intellectual work as labor. You know, I've done some adjunct organizing in my day around this town, and it's interesting about how people, you know, even someone who I don't know, teaches 8 classes a semester and makes about $20,000 or whatever a year, whatever, some ridiculous, I mean, there's people with even more ridiculous situations who kind of don't see what they're doing as work and don't see themselves as workers. I think that's one part of it, to unpack it. And I think the other thing else has to be, is for me, is this question of, you know, what's real? Well, you know, what's real and what's good?
Well, and what's necessary.
And I think that
some people in this conversation end up sort of at a sort of very complex space of we're all having this weird conversation that I feel like in the end kind of is constantly circling what is like necessary, what is necessary for humanity. Like, is art, like, questioning, is art and is writing necessary labor for humanity? Because, like, what's going to make something, like, is it, like, differentiate between something that is work and something that is leisure is partly the necessity of it.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think especially under, you know, we live in the culture that has such the rage for productivity and efficiency.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yes.
And it's weird because for me, it's, you know, thinking about that adjunct or the, quote, starving artist stereotype or whatever, it's like it becomes this weird way. It becomes a weapon against people who do that work. So I think that's a big part of it. And then also I think the other part about it, it's not completely separate, but I think it needs to be slightly differentiated between, you know, people who do work, look to creative works for some sense of truth, some sense of maybe exploring their own reality, and those folks who just want to get away from it all, and like the escapist, you know. And I will say, I hate escapism. I don't do sci-fi. I don't, you know.
And, you can also argue that escapism is still a necessary thing for humans and for humanity. You could still argue that creating escapism is necessary work, because without for a lot of people, without a certain amount of escapism, they would have trouble navigating the parts of their lives that then necessitate that escapism.
Isn't escapism just the little sugar pill that you've coated in some more heavy material? I mean, sci-fi.
Yeah, that's true. I love science fiction for its
noirish thrillers. Yeah. I mean, all of those are carrying, not even subtext. I mean, it's just right there.
Right there,
as far as issues with science and technology and culture.
But it can also be a solid escapism.
But
because
it's plot-driven.
Right. Yeah.
And that allows for a reader to kind of let those other issues kind of blow a little by, get some wind in their hair, but it's still there. And I think in a lot of sort of escapist literature doesn't get its due because it's doing more work, more of a kind of work in the broader culture than, say, the more academic things that are considered more academic.
Yeah.
So a Stephen King novel that deals with sort of, there's a monster, but it's a childhood abuse story, essentially,
yeah.
is what it's about. Yeah. Or it's a novel about male rage in America. Like The Shining is just about male rage in America in the 1980s. I think that has a broader impact and a more memorable function for the people who read it oftentimes than, say, reading T.S. Eliot or even like an Adrian Rich poem or something like that. It's going to dig in a little more.
Sometimes, depending
on the person.
Right.
Well, it depends on the person, yeah. I mean, because for me, it's like what I really like about your poetry, Christopher, and this collection of poems in particular, actually, I would say, is the sense of memory and place and the passage of time that's in all of these poems.
Yes.
And I, correct me if I'm wrong, though, Death of the Author, Roland Barthes freed me to say whatever the fuck I want about these poems, even if you are sitting
there. You go for it. Kenny's not there.
All right.
Yeah, it's... Sorry.
I'm just a construct of an author anyway.
Yeah, you're just a construct of an author. You're serving some sort of author function now because you're multiple books into your career, right? You're Foucauldian author function too, but that's a different podcast maybe. We'll see how we go. We're already 11 minutes in, so no time for Foucault, kids. Now,
there's always time for Foucault. Don't listen to it.
Ooh, no. Anyway, is this, you know, for me, is this, you know, thing about sort of reconstructing memory and being truthful in what, you know, whatever the work and thinking about the work as the material, not the labor created making it. That's what I mean by that work. You know, in terms of this is work, work itself. It's a
multifaceted title.
Yeah, title, yeah.
Well, and it's interesting that that's the thing that you're coming to because whenever we were kind of like, when we were joking that I was going to have to read all of Chris's poems, I was like, well, what would I read? And I was kind of just like paging through the manuscript and I came to the My Grandfather Storms the Beach at Normandy.
Oh,
and that
yeah,
like really, that kind of, that I feel like that poem really touches on a lot of what you're talking about because it is this like, reconstruction of memory, but it's like multiple levels of it.
Yeah, and how do you, you know, the thing about poetry as a medium, right, is this, there are all these different facets, all these different components, and you're trying to be sparse with words and sort of like creating this more vivid picture with less, right?
As Margaret tried laying this out, she found them really wordy.
You're not so much wordy as you have very long lines. He likes him a long line.
I like, just like my legs. That's what I like my lines.
You like your lines like your,
how I
like
measure
your
them
own
out.
Legs.
Yeah. But yeah, so for me that, you know, that idea of, you know, how does one then faithfully, you know, make a poem that's quote maybe aesthetically good, but perfectly captures that feeling, that emotion, that moment, that memory. Because, I mean, yeah, there's the My Grandfather Storms the Beach at Normandy, Capel's Jewelers, was it Stanton and Negley Drugs? See, all you folks, this book isn't even out yet, and I've read it, and it's great and wonderful, and you folks are just going to have to wait till August 25th, 26th?
26th.
August 26th
is
the release party of Whitewell Books. More on that later. But I think for me is... more than Stephen King or sci-fi or whatever, for me is it's like, wow, that is an intimate window into somebody's human experience and someone's very realistic human experience. For me, that's what I've always been drawn to. That is my bug zapper.
Well, and
when
one
it comes
things,
to
one of the things that I really love about Chris's poetry.
It's my DDT.
Yes.
And that's one of the things I really love about Chris's poetry and that I really love about the poems in this collection. Is that he, like, for example, he has these poems that while, like, they touch on, it's nice layering of him sort of, like, it's always the experience of the speaker, but also him basically sort of, like, reflecting the experience sometimes of the individual or individuals who he's interacting with. So it's not, I often see as an editor a lot of poetry that is trying to retell the story of somebody else, but without that without acknowledging the reflection of the writer or of the speaker in the poem.
Mm.
And I feel like what Chris does really beautifully and effectively is he presents his work and he writes his work with a consciousness of his own layer of the narrative and his speaker's own layering of a narrative. So when Chris writes about, I feel, when Chris writes about the experience of somebody else, like writing about his grandfather, for example, it's with a very particular consciousness at the same time that his own experience is layered into that experience.
Yeah, I feel very uncomfortable trying to write somebody else's experience.
Mm-hmm.
I stay away from that as much as possible.
And
in my
I appreciate
poems.
It.
What I like to try to present is a mind in motion in the poems.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
That I don't fixate on one thing. I try to move in a somewhat natural way. You know, you like to surprise a reader, like, oh, I didn't expect the poem to go there or end there, or that this is actually what this poem's about. I like the motion of the mind through the poem, that's the rhythm of the lines, that's how they're constructed. I don't do a lot of narrative type poems. There are a few, there are a couple in here that are more narratively structured than others. But yeah, my ideal is something that just kind of floats and the mind moves through sort of an emotional touchstone, maybe one or two, and there's the space in between those. And the poem is the movement between those spaces.
Well, and while I wouldn't necessarily call you like a surrealist writer, that is a sort of like Dada surrealist technique, though, of this idea of like these two things relate because I say they relate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, like placing two unlike things together and kind of trusting your reader to like help make that leap with you.
Yeah.
And I like that. I like that kind of movement in work that sometimes will to that goes unexpectedly because it's more than just a turn in a poem. It is going from like point A, not necessarily to point B, but to like point like R, and they do relate. And it's more than just because you say they relate, but the initial impulse is like these things relate because Chris said they relate, and now I have to figure out why.
Yeah.
But it's a delightful journey.
Yeah, the poem should take you that journey.
The poem should help you
in
that journey.
That way. And yeah, I don't. In writing, I do not start out with a place to go, ever. I never want to know where the poem's going, because I don't see any point in writing the poem if I know where it's going. I might have a line or two in my head that I've been carrying around, and a couple of images.
Yeah.
Like the, When My Mother Looked Like Stevie Nicks, that poem. I've carried that line, that image, for many, many years, and never written the poem or never really got the poem down. But it was when I finally did write it, it wasn't with the idea of this is where it's going to go or any of these poems. I don't enjoy that. I need a certain, what I get out of the poems is that journey. And to be surprised at the end, like, oh, I didn't know that's what was going to happen. And I'm glad it did. It was a valuable thing for me to do. And now let me see if I can tighten it up and then share it with other people. Because if it's not an valuable experience for me, why would I care to share it with an audience?
Well, and why continue to write if you're not writing for that pleasurable and engaging part of it that is the actual act of creation? The act of creation, I personally feel, should be a moment of discovery for yourself, too.
Yes.
And obviously, like, not everybody has to write how I say they should. But,
lay down the law, Margaret. Tell them.
Okay.
Yeah.
I feel like I do that a lot already, Chris.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I feel like part of what makes, if we want to briefly touch back on this idea of like art and poetry as work and labor, is that there is an element of like discovery in the moment and kind of like getting to that place where you can make those discoveries also.
That's largely the work, I feel, of being a poet, being an artist of any kind, is to kind of unlock those things inside of you and leave them unlocked so that when you're trying to create something, you can go to those places and come back with something of value, making air quotes.
No,
air quotes
yeah.
are aiding on value.
Use your air quotes, please.
Yeah, air quotes. It reminds me of something actually that Elliot Smith once said, or I once read an interview with Elliot Smith where he would sort of write songs like that, and once he, quote, figured out completely what a song was about, he would stop performing it live. It would go off the set list because he's like, well, it's already figured out for me, and there's nothing left.
You should always
left.
Hold a surprise.
Hold a surprise. Yeah. So speaking of which, actually, we get to another work, or we get to another poem. If there's your choice now. I chose the first one. I don't have to choose everything, you know.
Okay. I'll read on reading Dr. Joseph Krotek's obituary.
Mm.
And this was dedicated to Dan Shapiro, another Pittsburgh poet. I'll explain why later. But this was originally the first poem, I believe, before Margaret got her hands on it.
Ooh, to start with the obituary.
So for me, this is like the Rosetta Stone of the book, is from my understanding of how we put it together in the writing. So let's see if it actually is. I'm reading Dr. Joseph Krotek's obituary. Everyone is convinced they're prepared for what will happen. We sweat away for health insurance, life insurance, floss 100 times a day, cross in between the lines. We are prepared for nothing. Sometimes I'll come across a record I haven't heard in years, Errol Garner's Concert by the Sea, or that one Sinatra and Duke Ellington did together. Sometimes it's just some old rock and roll thing I loved in high school, and I think of it just about as often as I think of the way that building smelled, or Mr. Wheeler slamming some kid's head against the locker just to get his attention. All of which is to say, I almost never think about it, except for when suddenly it's right there, a song, a moment, a person I once loved, or someone who is just there and didn't mean much at all at the time. So when you're talking about memory, and the two major themes in this one would be memory and music. They kind of stitch everything together. And that poem, for me, kind of takes the two of them and crushes them together and slams their head up against the locker.
Yeah.
Central Catholic High School.
Yeah.
Woo! No, and that makes sense. That makes sense, the idea of it as a sort of Rosetta Stone, and those last four lines really strike me. You know, that idea, someone who was just there and didn't mean much at all at the time, and
so I think this is work is probably the text.
Yeah,
and that would be the subtext.
Oh. Yeah, absolutely, and. You know, thinking about how then, if you're thinking about then this writing process is a process of discovery, mm-hmm. in the way in which then the past also, we're talking about a true thing. we just talked about a true thing, and now we're talking about maybe how is it that memory has different meaning and different value, that's that ugly word again, over time.
See, and that's part of what I like about sequencing those two poems like that.
Yes.
You know,
yeah,
I like the idea of like going from like writing one true thing to then questioning
what is
truth. What is truth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah. That sequencing I felt also like on a subtle level.
And it also acknowledges, I think, you know, because there might be some fundamentalists out there. You know, I don't think they do. But if you are a fundamentalist, we're here to help. And I think, you know, it's this question of the memory exists in time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Memory exists in time and how things... Because I even think about that now because I had one of those big, you know, zero-digit birthdays last month. Thinking about how my past feels different now, or the way that I've come to understand things. And one thing that I talk a lot about, I always use this metaphor in class ever since I saw it, but one winter break, we binged watched the British Life on Mars series.
Oh, yeah.
If you've never seen that, there's this great episode where the whole premise is this guy goes back, he gets hit by a car, wakes up in 1973. When he was like 4 years old.
I've only seen the bad American version.
Oh, you gotta see the British version. It's so good. But there's a scene where, there's an episode where he turns the corner and he realizes this is the street he grew up on. or at least for a while, his family moved around a lot, and he knocks mm-hmm. on the front door of his house, and he interacts with his mother, and all of this stuff. And
isn't that a Twilight Zone episode?
Is a Twilight Zone episode too? Yeah, and he realizes what his parents were going through at the time. And I always think about, like, if I could go back to where I was four, like, how would I understand my life totally differently? Mm-hmm. And in a weird way, I think what we're talking about with your poems is these poems are maybe a vehicle for that. Mm-hmm. And I think it doesn't it also, and maybe thinking about editorial control here, like, kind of like, you know, but I mean, think about, again, what you're saying, Margaret, about what makes these poems interesting. Mm-hmm. Because doesn't that also allow the reader a place to live inside these poems? Again, death mm-hmm. of the author.
Right.
No, I mean, I was, I think.
They're on the page, they're out of my hands now.
Yeah, you're screwed.
Yeah.
Or liberated.
Yeah, or liberated. Or, yeah.
You don't have to answer to anybody now.
Well, he's going to ask
you a bunch of questions, actually. Yeah, I mean, I think that simultaneously acknowledging that we are all, that we're, you know, as writers and artists, we are striving to create something that feels true, but that also the idea of, like, truth is very shifty. I feel like it can be very, like, welcoming to a reader.
Mm-hmm.
Because it acknowledges the idea of the death of the author in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is a very helpful element in opening up a piece of art to a viewer, because I think sometimes we get obsessed with the idea of, like, what did the artist or the author specifically want to say? Mm-hmm. And I do believe that, like, once it is out of that person's hands, that is tertiary at best. Like,
because
you cannot control interpretation.
No.
And yeah, I've had my fair share of run-ins with people interpreting certain things that I've written where I can't really argue with them about it. It's like, I know what I meant. Mm-hmm. I know what that piece means to me, but you've read it and you bring your own experience and history to it. And I can't argue that. I'm sorry that it worked out that way. your perspective and the conversation I'm having with you now, I'd prefer to have avoided this. But here we are, and
that sounds like a saucy story.
It was at a funeral.
So not saucy at all. Oh, I'm more the sauciest, or fun. Depending.
Yeah.
But you can't argue against somebody's interpretation or experience of your work ever.
That can be an ongoing problem. Like, I don't, this might be a bit much to get into, but that can be an ongoing, like, larger problem of, like, art and social justice too, where at a certain point, like, what somebody means when they create something just kind of doesn't so much matter as how it ends up feeling to the people who then experience that work.
I mean, it does, and again, I think it's this question of this idea of, I think, living memory, or when you're talking about your Elizabethan playwrights, of course, the worst of the bunch was that William Shakespeare guy. Right? I mean, people in his own times, Christopher Marlowe, Ben Jonson, who we read as a poet, we don't read as a dramatist anymore at all.
I do not.
And then there is, of course, Time Magazine's man of the millennium, William Shakespeare, who was considered the quote, the great, you know, or now he was considered in his time. I mean, he was considered the Michael Bay of Elizabethan playwrights, you know, who just put on a really nice spectacle and not something you took seriously, you know. But I mean, that happens. But I think there's also, I mean, there's something, again, to
they might maybe have also just been jealous.
They might. Yeah. But I think it's maybe going back to, though, that appeal of certain kinds of evil isms, whether it's fundamentalism or whatever, that wouldn't it be great if the one true thing wasn't work and it was just in a book somewhere and you just could read it at face value and that's it, let alone that both of those books people get fundamentalist about the most. And I think the Constitution. Let's do the two big religious books and the Constitution. They are such schizophrenic works themselves. And in certain ways, there are these radical attempts of interpretation, of singular interpretation that people do that they actually kind of organize their lives around. Mm-hmm. You know, whether you're a Supreme Court justice or, you know, a member of the Topeka, that church in Kansas, to Fred Phelps Church.
Oh.
Westboro Baptist Church. Yeah. Sorry. Ah. I didn't have coffee today. I would have remembered that on cue if I had coffee today, but I did not have coffee. But
try to not remember the Westboro Baptist.
Yeah. But they're so hard to forget.
They are.
But I mean, and so I think, again, for me, that's what the value of, even if it creates this problem or whatever. I mean, again, for me, my favorite poem in the collection is Stanton and Eglie Drug.
Oh, yeah?
And I think for me about how I get in, well, first, I know what that is. That is a landmark. I drive, I know, you turn. Mm-hmm. If you want to go to Lawrenceville, you turn left at that. right? That's among other things. But also, again, I think for me, because it does have this reverberate that there are these multiple perspectives in a singular memory, and it accounts for other people are going to know these things too. Mm-hmm. And it, for me, is such a vivid picture, even though it's your personal experience, that for me, it invokes for me memories about things about my early childhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I grew up right across the street from Stanton and Eglie Drug. So.
Oh, wow, fantastic, yeah.
North Negley Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
You want me to read it?
Yeah, okay.
He clearly does.
Since you're such a fan.
Okay, Mr. Collins, if you want to.
I'm glad you like this one.
It's great. It's beautiful.
It's another one that's been kicking around for a while. I was like, I don't know.
No,
I get weirded out when I write about family. A bit. Like how much... Yeah. How do you do that work? Okay. Stanton and Negley Drug. At the Stanton and Negley Drug, they had an ice cream counter in back. Small, with a little wooden step, so little guys like me could get our chins up on the counter and watch the woman with salt and pepper hair scoop ice cream into the bright metal container for milkshakes. And my grandmother played her lottery numbers there religiously. The same numbers daily, straight and boxed. And sometimes we filled the squares of a lotto ticket together. With a pencil nub she pulled from her purse. And I looked at the crazy covers of comic books and Mad Magazine. And then we walked home. And once she yanked me back from the intersection so hard, I fell on my tender 5-year-old ass. And the truck went by honking, and we went home. And this happened so many times. I have no image of it. Only shadow things. The long old memories composed totally of words, because they exist for us only in the stories we've been told. Like the day I took a header from the second story porch and fell right past the rear door where my mother sat with her mother at the kitchen table and, terrified, saw my body fall, my head missing the concrete step by so little they say God was watching. And even though I was right there, again and again and again, I wasn't.
Wow.
I guess that's as close to narrative as I get.
Yeah.
It's also why I don't like heights.
Yeah, no, that would kill it for me. Which, you know, you said something interesting before you started, because, again, this was one that was kicking around, and I don't know, and if we could talk about, pre-podcast, we're having this very interesting conversation about editorial control, right? And so you're Chris, you're the poet and editor of Logos Press, and Margaret is seeing about what it takes when you put a manuscript together, when you get something, and it's for you, I guess. Yeah, you have sort of radically different approaches to
to
putting a collection together, and it is, again, understanding what. What the poet's trying to do or what its value is, or maybe what they don't see. Mm-hmm. Because, for you to say this poem was one that wasn't necessarily, that was a bubble poem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But for me, I it's just fantastic.
Thank you. Yeah, it's one of the things that as I was doing more of the writing. Mm-hmm. And really, it was the music poems that came late.
Mm.
So those are the most recent of the poems in the book. I mentioned Dan Shapiro earlier, local poet. I've seen Dan read many, many times, and he's a wonderful poet, and he's very sort of pop culturally concerned in his work. Like, he'll write a sequence of poems about the match game from the 70s. So if you want poems about, like, Gene Rayburn, Dan is your man. But he's able to do it in such a sort of artistically fluent way that I'm always kind of just kind of surprised and amazed by what he comes up with. And he writes a lot about music, very heavily about music. And when I wrote the poem about Dr. Krotek, who was my doctor as a little kid, it reminded me, in a way, of Dan's work, and that's why I dedicated it to him. It's not a Shapiro poem. It would ever be mistaken for one of Dan's poems, but the feeling in it as I was writing it really felt to me a bit of what I get when I hear some of Dan's poems, particularly his music poems. And that poem, as we were talking, kind of opened things up a bit, since it's both about music and memory.
Mm-hmm.
And I had all of these sort of more memory-centric poems that had been kicking around. Like I said, I don't often write sort of family poems. I live my family life. I don't often write it. It's like I don't write work poems. I live that life. So I don't really put a lot of that into the poems.
Yeah.
I spend enough time there. work, not with my family. I can always spend more time with my family. That all sort of came together through that poem. And once I had that, I went back and pulled more of the family memory type poems in.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just tried to shuffle them in such a way that it made sense as a linear experience for a reader
mm-hmm.
to move through. So that they were all starting to comment on one another. So later music poems shift backwards, making, you know, reference to the family poems. Like, there are two poems in here that talk about Elvis in one way or another, and they sit right next to each other. One is about betting on horses, which is kind of an homage to my grandmother and the lottery ticket. And in that poem that I just read, we fill out the lottery ticket with the pencil nub from her purse.
Yeah.
In the Pimlico ticket, I fill out a racing form with a pencil nub that I've stolen from a library. The following poem mentions Elvis, which the Pimlico poem does. So I was trying to back and forth as much as possible so that the threads were tied as tightly as I could make them. Because it's not like I set out to write a book about either music, memory, or family. But they all needed to talk to each other in some way.
And I like that. I like, though, that the poems all, they all have a, they're all having a conversation with each other, sort of like this ongoing, sort of a, like, sideways conversation with each other, but that, and so they are all very, like, when you read the collection all together, there is, like, absolutely a cohesion of it, and there's absolutely a sort of, like, I don't know, it's called, like a, it's a subtle conversation. It's not like all these poems that are very obviously like referencing each other. You know what I mean? There's no sort of like there. It's not heavy-handed. Like, I like the subtlety of the conversation.
Yeah.
That the conversation goes on between these poems, but that you're not being like smacked over the head with it. And I do also, as an editor, I like collections that are themed, and I like collections that are not just, like, the poet put together the last, like, 25 poems they had published in literary journals. Like, that's really super-duper not my thing at all.
Yeah.
Like, the fastest way to get me disinterested in your collection is to send me a group of poems that are just, like, the variety pack of poems.
Right. The KTEL poem collection.
And, yeah.
All the hits in one volume.
One volume.
Call now.
And I like the whole range of that, though, of like poems that have this, that are very clearly structured, like very, very, like collections that are very clearly structured to like be these poems that all work together, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, these poems. But I also really appreciate the more gentle version of mm-hmm. that interconnectedness and of that conversation. And that is how I feel about these poems. That there is sort of like a gentle subtlety to the conversation, but it's very obviously there. I don't think that you could read this manuscript and be like, I don't know how these all work together, you know? I like actually hearing you talk about this poem references this thing, this poem has this image in it that it, you know, that is related to this poem over here. Like, it's like this beautiful little treasure hunt.
It's the whole reason certain poems are mm-hmm. in, like the poem Pemlico again, mm-hmm. an older poem that I really didn't think much of until I came across it again and saw that it would reference things in two ways,
mm-hmm.
and that having I associate with my grandmother with a lot of things, but you know, she loved the lottery, she loved playing bingo, she loved to gamble, mm-hmm. so that always sort of for me, you mm-hmm. know, yeah, references it's an association with her, but it also moved in a different direction, sort of scouting ahead towards the Elvis poem, which is a poem about who knows what they're about. The poem I associate with artistic production and risk and failure.
Mm.
Which then also connects back to the idea of like what is work and mm-hmm. like where does art fit into this yep. greater construct of like how our lives go. And yeah, I like it.
Yeah.
I mean, hope I like it on publishing.
Yeah. And other folks should like it too, I think. So, there's such great poems. And I think all of these things, I think, you know, speaking of, you know, exploring worth or value or whatever, I think we're sort of touching on all of that, you know, is... Because you think about that subtext, that if it's not mm-hmm. a K-tell, you know, mm-hmm. poetry book, it's something that also does that. You know, lend itself to recursive reading.
Mm-hmm.
You know, speaking of living memory, living reading.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, we'll read it and we'll read it again and we'll read it maybe differently mm-hmm. as those memories have a different idea or have maybe a different impact, you know, as it moves forward. Mm-hmm. I think, anyway, I think that's what makes a good work.
Oh, yeah, and I mean, like, even, I think even sometimes upon revisiting a poem, even just like sequencing them slightly differently, I've noticed, can totally change how you read something and what you get from it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also why sequencing is such an interesting concept in like constructing a manuscript. Like, I know that as an editor, I've read manuscripts that have been submitted to me where I'm like, okay, each of these individual poems is very good. And each of these poems probably are supposed to live together,
mm-hmm.
but the sequence that they're in is actually detracting from the experience of the poems. And then there are some collections that I read where I'm like, well, you know, I'm not totally 100,000% on board with every single one of these poems, but the sequencing is like excellent. And I enjoy more the second variety.
Yeah.
And like, cause like, sequencing can really completely change your experience.
That's the most time we spend with logos mm-hmm. pressed up mm-hmm. is sequencing. That's like the key to all of those books is how they get sequenced. And what we spend so much time mm-hmm. thinking about and arguing with each other over and just debating, like, is this going to work? How does this change
mm-hmm.
What we're going for? What we want to leave the reader with mm-hmm. at the end of the book.
Yeah.
So yeah, sequencing. Like you say, a poem that doesn't really work very well just on its own
mm-hmm.
in a sequence ties certain things together sometimes
yeah.
in a really impactful way that on its own it just sits there. It's inert. But once you put it next to some other pieces, it just, you know, it's a flashbulb. It's like, oh, that's key to this. It has to be.
So can I confess something really ugly and terrible then?
Sure. If you please do. I love knowing people's ugly secrets.
Well, here it is. After taking account of everything you said, and it's very thoughtful and meaningful and all of that, a thing that I will do in bookstores often, if I don't know a poet, or if I'm confronted with, especially, well, just poetry, actually, a shelf of books of poetry that I don't know, and if I don't know the label and I don't know the poet.
Right.
Here's what I'll do.
You read a variety.
Yeah, I will pull.
Flip open, you just flip.
I will go somewhere, typically middle back, back of the book, and read that poem. And if that poem catches me, especially if it's in a used bookshop, I sail. And if that doesn't, I'll try one more. I'll read one more.
That's fair.
Give it a second chance.
Give it a second chance.
That's an expected kind of consumer strategy to poetry.
From
an editorial perspective.
Yeah. Well, it's horrifying, yes.
But I will say that from an editorial perspective, I do think that each individual poem should also be super solid. I do think that each individual poem should be able to be read on its own out of context of the rest of the manuscript, and that sequencing should add to the poem but not define it. And I feel as though you can mess up your sequencing as a writer, and that you can have a poem that's really good, and the poems around it's just like, it. You can have, like, I mean, sequencing is important in that it can add to the greater whole of the manuscript and the experience of this piece of art that is a book, and it can also detract from it. You can put poems in an order that just does not work, and that actually makes it lessens the experience of the reader in some way. So I guess, like, for me personally, that's more my sort of, like, because in, like, the reading period that I'm currently trying to plow through the rest of the manuscripts on, for Hyacinth Girl Press, we got so many submissions that my acceptance rate is going to be under 1% this year, which is kind of bananas.
Yeah, that's not, yeah.
But it also means that, like, I'm not just, like, I'm looking at, like, every single element of every single manuscript. It's not just, like, are these good poems? Because if it was just, are these good poems, like, I wouldn't be able to reject anything. You know, like, it would be so profoundly difficult. But it's title of the manuscript, it's titling of the poems, it is the sequencing of the manuscript, it is a million different things, and it's just, because I feel like one of the things that I really appreciate about Salsa Night at Hilo Town Tavern is the sequencing and the care with the interrelatedness of the poems. It brought to mind, like, how that is not easy. Like, that's not an easy thing to do. Like, putting your poems in order is not easy. And you can actually, you can make or break a manuscript with what order you put your perfectly good poems in. You know, you can have all of these, like, really good poems that were all published in, like, very respected literary journals, and that technically should all be together. Like, they're meant to be together. And then you can just totally bork the whole, like, the whole sequencing element. And then all of a sudden you have a manuscript that's just like, I don't know.
And so for Locos, this is a completely different process, right? There is no open reading period. There is... Right.
We build it from the ground up. We engage the writers that we want to work with, that we think we can work with. I mean, there are so many wonderful writers and writers that we admire. But we know... You know your own limitations as an editor, or in time that you can give, or, you know, you're really the grasp you have on a person's work should be, you know, pretty solid before you sit down and start talking to them about building a manuscript. So you want to have that, and you want the personalities to be right, because you're asking somebody to open themselves up to a process that can be difficult. And it requires of them patience and the ability to distance themselves from their own work and their own understanding or expectation of what that work's going to result in, which is hard to do. It's a lot to ask.
Yeah.
So the people that we've worked with who have been wonderful, I mean, they've all understood the process going in. We're very clear about it.
Yeah.
And that, but it is a lengthy process. There are arguments. There's a lot of beer to be drunk.
probably a little bit of crying.
Yeah. Usually on my part, like, it was done. It was done. Why are we changing this now? Don't do this to me. Like, no, I think we got to go this way. Like, okay. You're the artist. but it is. It's a lengthy experience, but it's really a valuable experience for, I think, mm-hmm. both sides. Both sides put as much as they possibly can into it. A lot of blood and tears are shed to get it right. Because the goal from both sides is we want this to be as good as it possibly can, mm-hmm. and to make sense from everybody's perspective, and everybody to know, like, this is, each book is kind of a statement, and mm-hmm. each book is designed to be a particular kind of journey. You mm-hmm. start here, and by the time you get to the end of the book, something has happened. Things have shifted. Things have moved. You're in a different place from one place to the next, from the start of the book to the end. And that's, you know, as a movement, you can go in so many different places,
yeah.
and you disagree about where those turns should be and where you're going. But it is. It's an incredible process. And we've, you know, me and Scott Silsby, who's been on your show, are the primary editors and the sequencers. Nathan Kokolsky does our copy editing, and he's a taskmaster at that, which is great. A lot of arguments there, too.
Yeah, I'm sure.
What do you mean you can't have that comma in there? Come on. It's just a comma. Let it go.
Generally, when I'm correcting people's commas, I don't tell them I corrected their commas. I just send them the proof with the corrected commas, and no one
they don't notice, then...
No one has ever been like, excuse me, you removed my comma. I just, like, pass it, like, here's
slide
your
it under
next
the door.
Proof. And, like, let's see if they notice the 50 commas that I fixed. Don't.
Yeah, we've had some sticklers. That's not a semicolon. It's like, but it's supposed to be a semicolon. things like that. But yeah, it's why it takes a long time to do, and mm-hmm. you know, we wouldn't do it any other way. I mean, I've worked. Margaret has been fantastic to work with.
Seriously. Well, I was telling Sarah Sarah Reck, who does all the layout and design work for Hyacinth Girl Press, and is my co-editor and better half of the press. I was telling her a couple days ago how delightfully responsive you are to any of our, like, comments or suggestions mm-hmm. or questions about, like, layout and design work, and about, like, the issue that we had with, like, because he does have incredibly long lines in some mm-hmm. of his poems. We had to discuss, like, is it the integrity of the line that's important, or is it, like, the, like, particular line break that's important? Like, what becomes mm-hmm. the more important element? Because due to, like, the size restrictions, which Chris is obviously familiar with, because Low Ghost books are, by their nature, very small books. Mm-hmm. So Chris was, to be fair, we got a little lucky on this, because Chris is an editor. He has worked with so many poets, and he produces books that are of, like, a smaller size. And so when we were like, so, we either have to, like, run some of your lines onto a second line, or we have to rework some line breaks. Like, he didn't have the, like, oh my goodness, oh no, kind of reaction that, I mean, to be fair, I've never had anybody, like, freak out at me about a line. But there have been some times where it was, like, a bunch of back and forth. Because poetry, because it is both a art of performance and an art of, it's also a visual art, mm-hmm. and it's also an art of, like, solitary reading. You have to kind of consider all three of those elements when you're publishing a book. And so sometimes for the poet, the visual element of how the line appears on the page is profoundly important for a plethora of reasons. And it can be whenever you have the inherent restriction of the style and size and shape of the books that you publish, then it becomes a kind of, like, it's not just like somebody sends you a manuscript, you take it and make it a PDF file, you print it, and out into the world it goes. It's like, there is, like, way more that goes into design work than
I can imagine.
Yeah, having had to do so much of that, mm-hmm. I understand the problematics of certain things. So in working with you, you were always going to be in charge of everything. As far as I was concerned, like whatever you wanted to do, mm-hmm. unless it profoundly disturbed my sleep, it was gonna happen because it's your book, it's your mm-hmm. press, and I trust you implicitly. We've known each other for so long.
We sure have.
But I also understand from an editorial mm-hmm. perspective mm-hmm. about what you need to do, what an editor really needs from
right.
the person writing the book to make the process go smoother.
Right. Whereas, so. Like, the funny thing is, like, whenever I'm approaching a manuscript, I approach it as, like, I'm like, okay, well, my job as an editor is to help this poet's intention and help this manuscript, like, be the most itself that it can be, essentially, because I've already selected it. Like, if I select a manuscript for publication, like, I already love it in the form that it's in, and then I feel like for my personal purposes as an editor, I feel that my job is to look at that manuscript and say, okay, here's what, as a reader and as an editor, I see this manuscript is doing, and I see as, like, what it feels as though from, like, my communication with the poet and from, like, having read the manuscript probably, like, 10 times before we even go to the process of starting, like, any editing or layout, where I feel this manuscript is going and where it has gone and where it's attempting to go. And then if I can do any small thing to, like, nudge it more so towards mm-hmm. those ends, I feel like that is what I'm there for. And so then when I go into a conversation with the poet about any, like, small, like, I have an incredibly light editorial hand overall.
Yeah.
Not in terms of copy editing. I'm actually not have a light editorial hand with copy editing. But I have a light editorial hand with when it comes to any sort of, like, artistic changes.
Mm.
And so perhaps one of the reasons that it's kind of worked really well with Chris and I is that each of us in the back of our minds is like, okay, this is what I want, this is what I'm feeling about this work, but I am happy and able to defer to this other person.
Yeah. And so that journey ends, yeah. right? August 26th at the White Whale Bookstore, right?
That yes, is at 7 p.m.
At 7 p.m., August 26th, White Whale Bookstore in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And that's August 26th, 2017, because the internet is forever.
Oh, that's true. Yes, we don't want people showing up, like, August 26th in 2019. Yeah, though I would find that hilarious.
That would be wonderful and sad. But hopefully you'll still have a copy of the book there, so you can still get it. Right, over that wonderful local author section. So again, so hyacinthgirlpress.com is where the news will
it
be.
Sure is. Mm-hmm.
And there'll be, and Logos Press has a blog spot. All of these things, there'll be links, and the book launch event page will be linked on our website. But now I think it's time for the bottom five.
All right.
You know, bottom five, series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. And I think
you well with philosophy.
Yes. Well. So here's the thing. So I think because we just had this lovely, lovely, lovey-dovey conversation about editorial control, and so we need one. I'm going to ask five questions, but you have to have one answer. You have
to agree
on
the
answer to these questions.
Okay.
And so we'll see how editorial control.
We'll end up asking each other questions about the question. This is
that's okay. It's
going to
be all right, but okay. That's all right.
Can we use a 20-sided die?
I didn't bring any. There's one in the closet in the other room.
If we're desperate.
If we're desperate. All right, question one. If reincarnation is real and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, what kind of disease or illness would you two be?
Okay, I would want to come back. Okay, what would you want to come back as? Let me ask you first, because I know what my knee-jerk response is, but it's probably different from yours because you're nicer than I am.
Well, according to William S. Burroughs, language is a virus, and since we're poets, we're already a disease vector.
Ha! Oh, wait, I like that better than mine! Already diseases! Yes! My answer was going to be one that, like, wipes out all of humanity but leaves the earth for the animals, but I also, like, we'll go with Chris's.
All right, question two.
I'm out.
Mic drop.
Oh, no, I have four more on my own.
Question two. What is the personal limitation or limit to experience that most people impose upon themselves?
That's an opinion, though.
Is this not multiple choice?
It's not multiple choice. The sheer existential horror of the prisons we choose to live inside.
Oh, so we're back to Foucault.
He's going to Doris Lessing instead. I mean, okay, so whenever I want to, like, super freak myself out, whenever I'm in the mood to have an existential crisis, which is more often than you might think, actually, I will go watch one of those YouTube videos where they try to show you your size relative to the universe. And, like, where they'll show you and then your size relative to, like, the planet and then, like, Earth's size relative to the sun. And then they just, like, keep on, like, zooming out. This is when I really want to, like, fuck with myself. because it gets to the point where, like, your brain can't conceptualize it anymore. Or, like, you think your brain can't. But there comes that moment for, like, a, like, millisecond when I'm trying to conceptualize it where, like, I go, like, where I'm, like, about to fall off the edge of reality in my mind, but I feel like that's a personal limitation that I've imposed on myself because I'm attempting to maintain my grasp of reality.
I like it.
It's good. I feel totally insignificant right now. So, well done.
That was my intention.
All right. Question three, then. We'll just move on.
We're doing good.
You guys are doing great. Question three. Out of all the possible ways to die, what is the way you least want to?
Oh, I least want to. Oh, man. Yes, I was going the other direction of that. I was like, okay. So I watch a lot of horror movies, so personally, I don't want to be cannibalized, but, like, I could, like, come up with a worse one.
Postmortem, or
once I die, who gives a shit?
Like, the Hannibal Lecter cutting you up.
Yeah, that one.
So my mother is a school crossing guard, and I have a morbid fear of dying in a traffic fatality where I'm not paying attention while crossing the street.
Oh.
The family shame would be...
can we say in a way that would bring shame upon our families? Yeah. Can we agree to that?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
In a way that would bring horrible shame upon our families. Because then you get yours, and, being eaten alive by cannibals would not necessarily bring shame upon my family, but, like, I would hate to, like, put my family in, like, through more. But I feel like that would put your family through a lot.
That would. Just writing the obituary would be cruel to them.
Yeah.
A way that would bring shame upon our family. Well, let's go with that.
All right. Question four. Maybe they get lighter, maybe not. Question four.
I feel like we're absolutely making light of these.
That's good. So, question four. If there's a hell and you end up there, name one celebrity that you both expect to and hope to meet.
Oh, hope to meet.
Yes.
I mean, expect to meet, I have a mile-long list, but hope to meet.
Hope to meet in hell.
In hell. I mean, I think that we could take this the route. I mean, I don't necessarily know if I want to be, like, having a conversation with the person. It would have to be somebody who, like, I really want to see suffer for me personally. Do you feel like it would also have to be someone you really want to see suffering? Or would it be somebody who you just...
We'd be in hell as well, I assume we'd be suffering.
We would be suffering.
Possibly
we would.
Their presence would be part of our suffering.
Could be that way. Or it could be, you know, the Mark Twain Letters from the Earth thing, that the more interesting, cool people end up in hell.
Yeah.
Mark Twain was just pretty convinced he was going to end up in hell and was trying to make excuses. And
probably,
make
himself
sound more interesting than he was, maybe.
Yeah. Is it Sartre that said other people?
Hell is other people.
So, I mean, so this is literally that. I
don't know. I'd kind of like to see Carnegie and Frick locked in that endless fistfight.
Oh!
since promises were made between them, I'd like to watch that.
Fun fact, Henry Clay Frick once owned the land that this house is on, that we're recording this podcast. Fun fact.
I mean, that could be, I mean, I don't know if I'd put that at, like, my tippy top, but, like, that would be at least, like, amusing.
It would be a show to take in.
It would be amusing. Like, would it would be them in their prime, or would it be them, like...
Just these desiccated
corpses. Or both. They're, like fist fighting as babies, and then fist fighting as toddler, like, through the whole...
They would have eternity. I would think they could do the spectrum.
I don't know the time functions the same way in hell, so
I have no idea.
They could go
apparently
through
we're
entire
find
life
out
cycles
question.
Over and over and over as they fight each other.
Cool.
Maybe in opposite directions, so you get to see an old Carnegie kicking baby Frick. So, I don't know. I'll go with Margaret's answer. I don't really have an answer.
No, I mean, I'm just like, I mean, that one, I mean, that's kind of, I feel like that's, now I'm just picture it. God,
now
I'm turning someone kicking babies. Now I'm definitely going to hell.
Yeah, darn. All right, question five. No one has... This is a virgin question. No one has gotten this question before.
Oh, no. Oh, yes. Oh, no.
All right. Name a movie... It's not even a question. It's a prompt. Name a movie world or the world of a film that you wish you could visit or live inside. If you could do the Gumby thing, but with, like, a DVD.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
a film that you wish you could live.
I mean... Probably, like, a really nice film, because, like, people who, like, say, like, oh, I'd live in the world of, like, Tolkien or Harry Potter. I'm like, so you want to die terribly.
Yeah.
So, like, and as I don't wish to be watching, like, Carnegie kick a baby Frick anytime soon.
Right, like, on the soft spot, too.
Right in the fontanelle or whatever. Like, since that's not on my, like, game plan for the week... I mean, I would go with something that was at least, like, somewhat pleasant, personally. Mm-hmm. Like, a world where, like, nice things happen. Not a world where I would just die horribly.
Is it like the Care Bear movie?
No, probably not the Care Bear. The Care Bear movie is also screwed up. I mean, like, if you'd asked me this... when I was, like, 10, I would have said The Little Mermaid. Like, 10-year-old Margaret super wanted to be a mermaid. When I grew up, I wanted to be a mermaid. Obviously, that's not possible. But if you'd asked me when I was, like, a wee kid, I'd been like, Little Mermaid. Wouldn't have gotten legs, though.
Yeah.
doing getting out of the ocean. Awesome down there. I don't know. Now they're like, I guess, like, this is gonna sound super stupid, but, like, I'm actually, like, really happy with my life. Like, there are things in the greater world that make me, like, sad and miserable, but, like, in the little tiny, like, tiny thing that's, like, you know, my home with my family and stuff, like, I'm pretty freaking happy. I mean, the greater world could stand to be changed
quite a bit.
So I guess, like, fantasizing about living in a different world altogether, like...
Or even just visit, you know, because Gumby would jump out.
Right. I don't know, Chris. I just want to be the Little Mermaid, and I don't think that's where you want to go, so this is going to be a difficult one.
Yeah. You're doing so well.
Yeah, I really like the world of Ridley Scott's Legend. For a number of reasons. One, it's very pretty.
Right, okay.
It's pretty when it's nice and happy and unicorns are everywhere.
Okay.
And Tom Cruise has beautiful hair. I think he's trying to do some kind of English accent. I don't know what he's doing, but it's great. And also,
God,
Tim Curry in that devil getup.
Yes.
Check, just hanging out with that guy for a little while.
Yeah.
I like that. Visually, it's a world I would like to visit and check out.
I am going to lose so much, like, cred of some manner when I say this. I tried to watch that movie one time.
How old were you? I think that
20-something?
Yeah, it's too old.
Yeah, I think that I came to it a little too late. And I tried to watch it, and I was like, this is super dragging. Also, like, why Tom Cruise?
Oh, yeah. He's totally miscast, which is part of the joy of that movie for me.
Right, because I never...
Just to watch him in his little tunic shorts.
Oh, my God. Mm. Oh, see, okay, if we went to that world, would I have to see Tom Cruise in the tunic
shorts?
It's
where he truly had all the right moves.
Because, I don't know if I want to visit a world where I have to see Tom Cruise in tunic shorts. I don't know if we're going to come to a consensus on this. What's our punishment if we don't come to a consensus?
I don't know. I think we just end the podcast. I think that's what it is. So
Chris wants to live with Tom Cruise in tunic shorts. I want to go be the Little Mermaid. Never the Twain shall meet.
And Billy Barty. Billy Barty is wonderful.
There you go. All right. So I think that's about it. So again, Salsa Night at the Hilo. There's no the.
Circling back around to the beginning.
I'm deleting this whole thing.
Start again.
Salsa Night at Hilo Town Tavern on Hyacinth Girl Press, right? So it'll be, and there'll be links to everything. The book launch party where you can go physically and hand American dollars to, or virtual, maybe Bitcoin. I don't know.
I don't take Bitcoin.
You don't take Bitcoin. Don't take cryptocurrency. You gotta watch your tracks these days.
Square reader.
Square reader. There we go. August 26th at the White Whale Bookstore. August 26th, 2017 at the White Whale Bookstore in Bloomfield, Pennsylvania. Bloomfield, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Me Talk Good podcast, yeah. But there'll be links to all that stuff on the website. And when the... we'll send you to hyacinthgirlpress.com. And when the dedicated page goes up and live, and when you can actually buy the book, for those of you who aren't local, we'll fix that too. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it'll be about something. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is GonnaDiePodcast.com. We're also on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at GonnaDiePodcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. Later, meats.